You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
The book of Matthew, we've been studying through this book, getting an up-close and personal look at the life of Jesus Christ. And, in Matthew chapter 9, where we left off last week, verse 35, Matthew gives us a summary of what he's been talking about for the past several chapters. He says, Jesus went through all the towns and villages, this is in northern Israel, Galilee area, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. And so we saw there were several chapters where we got a real clear, lengthy example of Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. And then the last couple of chapters, we've seen Jesus Matthew gives us different examples of Jesus' miraculous healing ministry, where God the Father is affirming Jesus as the promised one, the Messiah, the Savior that he promised to send into the world. He's affirming him through supernatural signs and wonders. And you know, the types of things that Jesus has been teaching is central to the mission why he came to earth. Like we saw last week, that Jesus came to seek and save the lost. That Jesus says, you know, I'm like a doctor, and a doctor doesn't go to healthy people. A doctor goes to find sick people, to make them well. And he says, I've not come to call the quote-unquote righteous, people that don't think they've got a problem, people that don't think they've got anything wrong with them or any problem between them and God, because they're totally deceived. He said, I've come for the people that know they're messed up, that know that they've got a problem, and know they need God's forgiveness. And so that's the mission. That's the reason why Jesus came into the world. And it says he was going all over the place. We saw his celebrity status began to skyrocket with the miracles he was performing last week. The crowd's pressing in upon him. If people want to get to him, they've got to fight their way through. They've got to, one guy actually had to go up to the roof and lower in like, one of those guys in WWF out of the ceiling to make his entrance, except he was paralyzed. So that's one difference. But, his friends lowered him down in just to get to Jesus because they couldn't reach him. And it says Jesus was going through all the towns and villages in that area. Well, that's actually quite a sizable number of people that he was interacting with. According to Josephus, the historian, there were 204 villages and cities up in northern Israel. And he says they all contained at least 15,000 people each, which amounts to over 2 million people. Now, even if Josephus is exaggerating somewhat, it still was a very large number of people. And Jesus' fame was spreading throughout that region. The need here is overwhelming. You got one guy, and you've got all of these people, a vast ocean of need. And they're all trying to get to Jesus because they know that he can meet their needs. Well, Jesus acknowledges this need in Matthew 9:36. It says, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into the harvest field. And so Jesus, as he's confronted with this need, we see a couple of different actions that he takes. One, he saw the crowds. He saw the need. He was not tucked away in his study somewhere reading his books. Jesus was the kind of guy that was right out there in and among the common people, seeing the real needs that people had. He came face to face with the incredible neediness of the people around him, the lost people, the sick people that needed salvation that he came to bring. But he didn't just see the crowds, because sometimes, you can kind of get numb. You start interacting with hurting, needy people. But Jesus actually had compassion on them. He allowed himself to care. He allowed himself to feel pain for the state that these people were in. You know, he wasn't like the Pharisees who saw the masses and judged them and said, why can't you be more like me? Why can't you get it together? Not at all. There was not any of that arrogance in Christ. Jesus cared for the people. He saw their pain. He felt their pain. He didn't just see it. He felt compassion. His heart went out to them as he saw this huge need. And it says, he tells his disciples, you need to ask the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest field. And I think the natural inclination is when you see a need and you're moved by this need, to immediately go out yourself and begin to try to meet that need. And what Jesus says here is he says to his disciples, we need to pray. We need to ask the Lord of the harvest. He's making an analogy from farming here. He says, you look out and you see the harvest is ready. The fruit is right there hanging on the trees. But he says, this is God's harvest. This is his field. These are his people who he created, who he loves, who first and foremost have rebelled against him. People who he knows. People who he has a plan to reach. People he wants to reach. And the first step we need to take is we need to take our eyes, you know, we need to see the need, but then we need to take our eyes and turn them up to God and to ask him about his harvest, to pray that God would send workers into this harvest. You know, of course, there's the implied, there's the implication that I'll go, I'll do whatever you ask me to do to meet this need, but we need to turn to him first. He knows you, he knows them, and he knows the best way to go about this. He's got a plan here. And so Jesus says we need to pray. And it's when a Christian community really begins to see and interact with the need, the lost people around us, when we begin to feel compassion, to care about these people. And when we turn our eyes to God and start to pray for the people that we meet, to pray for the harvest, that's a ripe environment for God to begin to call qualified, motivated Christian workers out of that group and to deploy them into different parts of the harvest. And so Jesus sees the need, feels the need, and he prays to the Lord of the harvest for the need. And then, in Matthew chapter 10, verse 1, he takes some action. You know, up until now, he's been traveling around directly meeting the needs. The disciples have been with him. Probably not all of them all the time, but there's a main core. He says he called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. And so Jesus takes the authority that he's been demonstrating over and over again. He imparts this authority to his disciples. And these 12 disciples, you know, he had a lot of other disciples, but these guys were special. These guys were specially called, commissioned, and authorized to be his witnesses. And it goes on, it says in verse 2, these are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, who's called Peter, and his brother Andrew. And Matthew gives them to us in six pairs. Okay, so we've got these two brothers. We've got two more brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee. Philip and Bartholomew, guys who were friends before they ever met Christ. Philip was the one that actually brought Bartholomew, invited him to be a follower of Jesus, otherwise known as Bartholomew, otherwise known as Nathaniel. Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. We met Matthew last week. He's the author of this book. Thomas of the famous Doubting Thomas name. James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. Thaddeus was also called Judas, but may have changed his name to Thaddeus at some point for obvious reasons. And Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. The gospel writers always seem to mention that whenever they mention Judas. You get the impression they're still kind of upset about that whole Judas betraying Jesus thing. But these were the 12. And it says that Jesus called them to him, he gave them authority, and then these 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. And so Jesus is going to send out his disciples on this mission. This mission he had already been a part of. He sends them out to accomplish that mission, but for the first time without him. Now, a couple points that need to be made here. First of all, Christianity does involve a mission. Contrary to what a lot of Christians convey, there is a mission that God has given us, a purpose. A rescue mission is what it is. It's going out into this world, telling people about this forgiveness that Jesus offers, and praying for people, seeking to persuade people, loving people, ultimately with the hope of them receiving Christ, receiving this forgiveness, and then in turn joining alongside of us as a worker in this harvest. So it involves a mission, and God works through humans. Strange as it might sound, you know, the God of the universe, who could certainly, is powerful enough to appear to each person individually and to tell them about Jesus, instead has chosen to work through human beings. Like we saw just the previous verse, he says, pray that the Lord of the harvest would send workers for his harvest. And so this is something that God has always done. He's always calling, he's always selecting human beings to be part of what he's accomplishing here on earth. This chapter we're going to read here, this was a special situation. This was a unique situation for them, a special mission that he sent them on. But this does include principles for us. And we'll see that, you know, even as he gets partway through, he switches from this specific mission I'm sending you out on, which could have lasted several months. He switches to, he kind of looks out to the horizon. He looks out to the time after his death and resurrection and gives them instruction about that mission that they're going to be on as well. And so we want to try and distill five distinct principles from this passage. Principles of ministry, which is just another way of saying service, service for God. And so let's look at these. And the first one we see right here in verse 1, that Jesus gave them authority. And so we go in the authority of Jesus. That's our first principle. The disciples went in the authority of Jesus, this incredible authority, unlike anything they'd ever seen before. He delegated some of this authority to them. He authorized them to teach and to preach the message that he had, his authoritative teaching. He also authorized them, he actually gave them authority over sickness, disease, demons, and they end up doing some miracles to confirm that these guys are with Christ. You know, Christ had been out throughout these areas. He'd sowed some seeds into these different towns. His fame was spreading. And so now he's sending his disciples in really to do some follow-up here with some of the preaching that he's already done as well as some initial preaching of their own. So he gave them authority. And, you know, they would have been acutely aware of the differences between Jesus and them. You know, they really, you know, imagine sitting there in with the 12 disciples, and you're like, all right, Jesus, where are we going next? And Jesus is like, well, it depends on what you mean by we. You guys are going to try this on your own. Imagine how terrifying that must have been. You know, the crowds were not here to see the disciples. You know, they were, if anything, they were pushing the disciples out of the way so they could get to Jesus. You know, it was like, you know, when you go to a party with a friend of yours that's way better looking than you. I mean, Jesus basically had 12 wingmen wherever he went. And they're like, look, Jesus, you are the celebrity. We're just the minions, all right? We're hoping that we can get some kickbacks when you enter into your kingdom. They thought he was going to set himself up as the king of the world at this time. And so they realize, you know, the things he's doing, there's no way I could do that. I'm sure they were thinking about all the problems that they had, all the ways that they continue to mess up, the ways they can't even get along with each other half of the time. They were very aware of these shortcomings that they have. And for any person that's ever stepped out to do anything significant as part of this mission, anything spiritually significant, you know how this feels, this incredible sense of inadequacy, this feeling that there is no way that I could do that. You know, maybe there's some really respected spiritual person that I know that could do that, but not me. And so we're plagued by a sense of guilt, by a sense of inadequacy, by a sense of incompetence. We feel like complete failures every time maybe we even open our mouths. And we've got to remember passages like this one and also passages like 2 Corinthians chapter 3, where Paul says, it's not that we think we're qualified to do anything on our own. Our qualification comes from God. He has enabled us to be ministers of His new covenant. The only reason we're qualified to do anything is because God has authorized us as Christian believers. You know, we've got it even better than them. We're indwelt by His Holy Spirit to guide us, to empower us. That's the only reason we're able to do any kind of ministry for God. And so I strongly advise you, if you ever want to get into ministry, that you memorize this verse and that you inscribe it on the inside page of the front page of your Bible. Because this is a spiritual lifesaver. You will never get anywhere in ministry if you go in thinking this has to be in my own authority. This has to be my own competence, my own adequacy. That's what makes me qualified to serve God. No way! And if you take that approach, you're just going to walk around. You're either going to be really arrogant because you're trying to puff yourself up to make yourself feel like I'm sweet. Or, more likely, that's going to come crashing down on you. And you're going to walk around kicking yourself and beating yourself up. You know, you're going to step up to try to teach the Bible and just feel such an incredible sense of shame. I haven't done enough. I'm not good enough. Who am I to stand up there? And God says, I'll tell you who you are. You're my son and my daughter, who I've forgiven. We need to remember, if God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, will he not freely give us all things? That neither life nor death nor anything under the sun can separate us from the love of God. We have to take our stand there. And what that means is that normal Christians can do amazing supernatural work for God. People like you and me, we can do pretty incredible things for God. When we've been authorized by Him, when we go in the name of Jesus as His representatives, as those who've been redeemed by Him, it's pretty incredible the kind of things that you can step out and do when you're indwelt by God. When God has called you to do something, you say, yes, I will do that. And you go and do that no matter how inadequate you feel. You know, there still is, of course, a need for training, to get equipped, to learn your Bible. And, you know, there probably would be some sins that would disqualify you from being used by God in certain areas. But a lot of times, the things that we're feeling real guilty about, the things that we're feeling like disqualify us, are not those things. It's kind of average, run-of-the-mill sin that every Christian struggles with. And, you know, if God didn't let somebody serve Him that had a lust problem, if He didn't let people serve Him that had some of an anger problem, that had trouble getting along with people, there'd be nobody to accomplish this mission. And so we can do amazing supernatural work for God. A lot of us here can testify to this. You know, I don't know if you remember the first time that God called you, that God sent you to do something significant for Him. You know, maybe He called on you to start trying to speak up and to share your faith with some people that you know. And you're like, I don't even know where to start with that. What if they ask me a question? What if and I don't know how to answer it? What if I ruin it? What if I turn them off from Christianity forever? Or, you know, when God asked you to trying to teach the Bible to this newer believer, this young believer. You know, when God came to you and said, I need you to teach this Bible study. Or, I need you to step up and lead this group. Maybe you had the same look on your face that the disciples had on their face when Jesus called on them to do this. It's kind of funny to be on the other end of this sometime where you're the one saying, I think you need to step up and lead this group. And just to see the look of horror on people's face, you know, like that possum right before you ran him over with your car. It's kind of this. But we've got to believe in people. Good leaders believe that people can do significant work, and they try and set them up to succeed. They try to give them things to do. They don't hog the ball and say, oh, I'm the only one that's authorized here. They believe, no, I want to try and get as many people as possible in on this because this is a pretty big mission. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. We need more workers is what we need. So we go in the authority of Jesus. A second point that is implicit in Matthew, but that Mark spells out for us clearly, in his account, Mark says in Mark 6, 7, calling the 12 to him, he sent them out two by two and gave them authority. And so, you know, he didn't send out 12 disciples 12 different directions, but he sent them out in pairs. I think that's probably why Matthew gave us the disciples in pairs. It was probably the groupings. And so Jesus sent the disciples out two by two. Apparently Jesus felt like six teams was a lot better than 12 individuals. And so the second principle is we go in teams. We don't do this alone. There's no place for the Lone Ranger or Christian worker here. In almost every case, God calls on us to work together. And this is the pattern we see continued right on through the rest of the New Testament. Read the book of Acts and try and find any Christian believer that's by himself. Yeah, there were cases where, you know, they might have died and so they had to flee. But, you know, it's pretty hard to find anybody by themselves. If they lose, you know, if Paul loses his one guy he was going to go with, he finds another guy to go with. Even when he's by himself in prison, he's like, please come quickly. Almost everybody has deserted me. So God calls on us to work together in teams. And there's a lot of advantages to this. You know, for one, we're better able to resist temptation. I know a lot of Christian leaders that will not travel anywhere to conferences, to speak, without bringing somebody along with them. Because when you're by yourself, like we were talking about last week, sometimes you'll see somebody become a Christian coming out of a real intense party lifestyle. And, you know, they often make one of two mistakes. They either leave all their old friends behind and they don't tell any of them about Jesus. Or they try and go right back in by themselves, and they get sucked back in to their old way of life. I say there's a third option. Bring somebody with you to talk, you know, to meet some of your friends, to befriend them, to be able to show them what the love of Christ looks like in your relationship with each other. You know, if there's another believer there, the temptation drops astronomically. It's when you're alone. That's when you end up getting into trouble. And so as a team, it's far easier to resist temptation. You also benefit from from your teammates' strengths. You know, all of our home churches here, we're all led by teams. I really like leading on a team because, you know, I've got some strengths, but I've got weaknesses. And I like having co-leaders, co-workers that have strengths that I just don't have. I also like having that ones that have strengths that I do have because then there's just more of us to be used in that particular way. And so we can benefit from their strengths. You know, I had a hard time with this for a while. I just wanted to go at it on my own. I didn't want to have to mess with my co-leader. In fact, I was, for several years, I was co-leading a Christian ministry house with a guy who I just didn't really like or respect or think he had anything to offer me. And I kept wishing our house would grow so that I could plant and get away from this dude. But, you know, God said, no, you're going to stick in here with this guy until you, one, learn to appreciate his strengths and learn how to value this brother who's a lot different than you, a lot different than you. So you learn to appreciate him. And also till you learn from him, he's got some things that you need to learn. And also in the meantime, the guys that you're in with, they've got things that they need him for as well. They'd be in real trouble if it was just you. It took me a while to finally come around to that conclusion, to really learn to appreciate this brother. And I'm so glad that I did, because I learned a lot from him that I'm not sure, I think it would have taken me a long time to learn if I had not learned my lesson from this person God had placed in my life. You know, it's no accident. The people that you're leading with, that's not just like random chance. God says he's placed the members of the body just as he desired, just as he pleases. And so we need to take that on faith and believe that God's got this person here for a reason. Maybe I need to learn how to get along with this person. You avoid loneliness and burnout by leading in teams, by going together. You know, times where you just can't go on, you've got somebody there who can pick up the pack and carry it for a while. I feel like no matter how difficult the work I'm doing is, no matter how few results I'm seeing, if I'm there with people who I love and who I know are like-minded, I feel like I can handle almost anything if I'm in that situation. Also, burnout, you know, people will know when you need to slow down, know when you're pushing yourself too hard. It's good to have a teammate there. Also, you benefit from their weaknesses. You know, the things that are annoying about them. God says you need to learn how to be real close to somebody that is really annoying in this particular area. Somebody who you just don't agree with at all. You don't understand how they could be so stupid to think that this is the way that you should do this. Maybe you're on a team where the whole team thinks you should take a different direction, and God's saying, do you believe it's possible that your idea is not the best idea? And that if everyone else in your life is telling you one thing, that you might actually be wrong. Do you believe it's possible? Is it possible for you to go along with something you don't completely agree with? Or do you always have to have your way? There's so many benefits to leading in teams. It's so good for your own spiritual growth and just to learn how to love people that are hard to love. Because I got news for you. Everybody's hard to love in some way or another. Everybody's got problems. And by sending people out in teams, this will be one of the main ways that God continues to bring about spiritual maturity in your life, probably for the rest of your Christian life. Now, this is one of those that never gets old. You never figure it all out. So you need to learn how to start working with people. And this is why Jesus sent them out in this way, and this is what they continued to do. So we go in teams, and he says, these 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. So he's got a lengthy teaching here on what he wants them to do. He says, do not go among the Gentiles, the non-Jews, or enter any town of the Samaritans, the half-Jews. Just go to the full-blooded Jews, the lost sheep of Israel. And so Jesus restricts their mission here. He says, don't just go out and start talking to anybody. What we're going to do here is we're going to focus, we're going to prioritize this ministry. We're going to hone in on one particular group of people. And so a third principle we can learn from this is that we focus our efforts. We focus our efforts. You know, in this case, it's on a particular field. We focus on one particular field. He's focusing on the lost sheep of Israel. There's probably a number of reasons for this. You know, we even see this in the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul. He would first go to the Jews in a particular city. Probably because they had the scriptures, they had the biblical worldview, they were waiting for the Messiah. They should be expecting to hear some news about this any day now, any year now. And so he went to them first. And so, you know, they should have been more receptive, at least, even if they weren't necessarily in a lot of cases. But this was a temporary restriction. We see he clearly lifts this restriction later on. The last three verses of Matthew is a pretty famous passage where he says, I want you to go into the whole world, to all the nations, tell everybody. So we're no longer restricted here. Clearly God wants, you know, as a result of what Christ has done, we can go into the whole world and tell everybody about Jesus and this forgiveness that he offers. But, you know, even under these conditions, we're not going to accomplish anything if we try to meet all the needs at the same time. It's a great way to burn yourself out. It's a great way to not get anything done. You'll even see sometimes companies will do this where things will start to go bad or a recession will happen and they'll just kind of start flailing in all these different directions. And that spells sure doom. See, there's this ocean of need out there. And unless we can set aside certain needs, unless we can focus in on the needs that God has called us to meet, then we're never going to get anywhere. You know, there's some of us here in this room who we're not in college anymore. We have regular career jobs with people who are older. Because we feel like God has still called us to be here in this ministry, we realize there's going to be some sacrifice. We're not going to be able to do as good of a job reaching out to friends in our neighborhood, friends at work. You know, that's a sacrifice that we're willing to make. Sure, we're still friendly to people. Sure, we still try and share Christ with people. But we're limited in our efforts there because we're spending a lot of energy somewhere else. So, you know, it's a choice to focus on a different field. You know, in our case, and for some of us here, it's a different field. We're kind of like missionaries to a different culture. And so, you know, focusing our efforts on a particular field, God will call us to do that sometimes, and not just to get real diffuse and scatter everywhere. He brings up this focus point again a few verses later. It's a little bit different here. He says in verse 11, whatever town or village you enter, search for some worthy person there and stay at his house until you leave that city. As you enter the home, give it your greeting. If the home is deserving, let your peace rest on it. If it is not, let your peace return to you. And so not only are we focusing on particular fields sometimes, but we also may need to focus on particular people within that field. And Jesus calls this the worthy person. What is this person worthy of me spending a lot of time and effort and emotional energy trying to minister to them? So how can we tell? What is the criteria if this person is worthy of my investment? You know, should we look for the most prestigious person, the wealthiest person, as is tempting to do a lot of the time? Actually, no. Oh, what about, are we looking for the poorest person? Are we looking for the neediest person? Jesus says none of the above. He says the criteria is if anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. So do they welcome you? Do they listen to your words? And with listening, it's also implied, are they obeying what Jesus teaches? So we're focusing on the responsive within that particular field. On the responsive within that particular field. He says people that aren't responsive, he says, shake the dust off your feet, which is something that Jews would do when they would pass through like a Gentile area of the country. They would get out and they would like shake the dust off their feet as kind of this like, as kind of a curse on where they'd just gone through. Part of it was like, thank God I made it through and didn't get killed by those evil Gentiles. Part of it was kind of like, I got this gross Gentile dust all over me and I need to get that off of my feet. And so it was really pronouncing God's judgment on the area they just passed through. And so what they were saying here was, they're pronouncing God's judgment. You guys are as far from God as the Gentiles. That would have been pretty offensive. You know, he even spells it out. He says, I tell you the truth, it will be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. Because they've had so much revelation, so much light, and they still aren't responding to it. He says, they're in for trouble. And so this is, you know, we should respond to what God shows us. Just sitting here through this teaching tonight, you're more responsible because you've received more light. And you've got to ask, how am I going to respond to that light, the truth that God has shown me? And so this idea that we actually would leave a an unresponsive person behind is pretty hard for some people to handle. You know, for some people that seems really cruel. Why is this the right move? Why is this actually a kind thing for us to do? A couple reasons. For one, if somebody doesn't want to hear about Jesus, and we continue to press the issue after they've asked us to stop, we may further alienate them. I was talking to a girl just recently who was turned off to Christianity for a while because she went out to this Bible study one time, and this Christian just kept calling her again and again and again and again to ask her to come. We don't want to turn into these spiritual telemarketers that just pound on people and pester people when they're clearly not interested. You know, just hammering away, like if I just manipulate or whine or plead or force them or overwhelm them, that's somehow going to take an unwilling person and make them willing. It actually can alienate them even further. They can get more and more angry at God and Christianity and say, you know, even if they get to a point where they're like maybe interested, they're like, there's no way I'm looking into Christ. You know, it's kind of like a callus that you build up in people if you keep trying to poke at them. Two, they may be responsive later. That's something we've got to consider. We should wait until God prepares their heart. Sometimes the best thing somebody can do is clearly reject Christ and then go off and see how awful it is to live for the world. How a life apart from Him has no answers. It's nothing like it seemed like it would be. Again, I've talked to some people recently who were totally unwilling, angry, bitter at the church, walked away for a year or more, and then drifted back in like, I was so wrong, and I've had the worst year of my life. I've had the worst summer of my life. And now I'm ready to pay a little more attention to what Jesus says about how to have a fulfilling, righteous life. Sometimes it's the best thing that can happen to somebody, and for you to continue to hammer on them, maybe you just need to let God do some work on them. Maybe you need to let them just experience the fruit of how they think things should be done. And third, while some people are unresponsive, other people get an opportunity to hear. And instead of wasting your time just hammering on the same person, find somebody else who wants to hear it. Jesus tells a parable where this rich guy decided to have a huge banquet. And he says, I want you to go out and get all these people. Here's the list of invites. And they go out and they ask person after person. And most people are like, sorry, I can't make it. I'm busy. And so they come back to the guy and they're like, well, there's not going to be that many people here because nobody was interested. And the guy goes, that is BS. I want you to get back out there and go find some different people. All right? I'm having a party. And you got to go find some people for my party because it's going to be a good party. All right? And that's what Jesus is saying to you. He says, you know what? Go find somebody that wants to sit down at this awesome meal here. It cost me a lot. It cost me my life. Why don't you go find anybody, somebody, you know, it may take some work, all right? It may take some searching. People aren't going to throw themselves at you, but, you know, it's getting into people's life and showing them what Christ offers. There's so many people, I'm sure of it, who are just crying out for answers. And you're wasting your time on somebody that doesn't even care and is getting more angry by the day as you hammer away at them. We can't make things happen when God isn't doing it. We can't make, you know, some of us have more of a Messiah complex than Jesus, who was the Messiah. Okay? It's like we think that I'm the answer to this person's problems and I'm the one that can make an unwilling person willing. No way. Jesus says some people just don't want to hear this. And don't, you know, maybe you need to move on. Our responsibility is to declare, not to cause a certain outcome. Sure, we're patient, we're loving, it's, we're working here to try and make the gospel as clear as possible. But there comes a point when that person just doesn't want to hear this. And so we're not responsible for the outcome. We're responsible to be faithful with what God's entrusted to us. And failure to move on suggests that we think that we must do it. I think that's some of our problem here. You know, for some of us, I think it's maybe we want the person to like us. You know, it's like their approval of us means more than God's approval of us. But, you know, I think in some cases we just feel like I'm the one that's going to save this person. And that you're not that person. Jesus is the one to save that person. But He's not going to force Himself on them. Jesus is not going to force Himself on you. He doesn't want you to either. So, we focus on the responsive. We focus our efforts on a particular field and on the responsive within that field. He says, as you go, preach this message. The kingdom of heaven is near. Heal the sick. Raise the dead. Cleanse those who have leprosy. Drive out demons. All the things they'd seen Jesus do already. Freely you have received, freely give. This power has been authorized to you. Freely give it out. Do not take along any gold or silver or copper in your belts. Take no bag for the journey or extra tunic or sandals or a staff, for the worker is worth his keep. So imagine setting out on a several-month journey with only the clothes on your back. No money, no credit cards, no cell phone. Just go out, you and your buddy. That's what he's calling on them to do, and he says the worker is worth his keep. Again, another principle we learn here is that we must learn to trust God. That's what Jesus is teaching them. Now, this was another temporary restriction that he placed on them, a temporary situation here. Now, later, right before he goes to the cross, he says this. He says, when I sent you without a purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. He said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it. I guess fanny packs would apply here as well. And also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. So Jesus says, before, when you went out with nothing, didn't God provide everything for you? And they're like, yeah. He says, okay, now you can bring your stuff. I've never really understood that part about the sword, but I know there's a couple D&D guys in this room right now going, yes! Finally! What about my chainmail? Now, probably because it was dangerous where he was sending them. They're walking down the road, the robber sees the sword, maybe he's going to turn away. But, the point here is the worker is worthy of his wages. God's work done in God's way will receive God's provision. God will take care of you. I don't know if you believe that. Jesus has taught on this several times already. He says, seek first God's kingdom, God's righteousness, and all these other things. He will add those to you. He says, don't worry about those other things. Do you believe that God is going to take care of you? Ministry, you're putting yourself out on a limb here. You're sacrificing a lot. And the question you've got to ask is, do I believe God? Do I trust God to come through for me? In fact, this is pretty central to doing ministry. With ministry, it requires that we trust God in many ways. And I just want to read through most of the rest of what Jesus is teaching here somewhat rapidly, but I think that I want to read it because I think it has a cumulative effect, and we see over and over again the different ways that he's calling on them to trust him. Verse 16, he says, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves, therefore be as shrewd as snakes, as innocent as doves. There's got to be a certain prudence to us, a certain cleverness, ability to think quickly on our feet, and yet not, getting into sin and crossing the line into immorality. But there's going to be some things coming at you. You're going to need to be quick on your feet. Especially the sorts of things that they were going to come up against. Really, in this section here, we see them depart from his instructions for this initial mission, and we see him start to give them instructions about the future mission that they would have, the things that are even more relevant to our lives. He says, be on your guard against men. They will hand you over to the local synagogues and flog you in their local councils and flog you in their synagogues. Flogging, a brutal practice. It was a leather whip cut into four strands, with those even cut into other strands with pieces of metal and glass in them. They would actually do this right at the synagogue service. They had a pillar. They would tie the person's hands around this pillar, and the Mishnah says they need to do a third of the lashes across the person's chest and then the other two-thirds across their back. He says, you're going to be dragged in front of your neighbors, and you're going to be completely humiliated. Flogged in the synagogues. And on my account, he says, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. And so again, this is, I think, evidence that this is not talking about this initial journey, because there's no evidence that they were flogged. He's talking about Gentiles here that they're going to be brought before. This is talking about the church future. He says, when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you'll be given what to say, for it will not be you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. Do you trust God in the midst of extreme suffering? Far greater suffering than you ever expected. The disciples, they may not have been ready for this suffering piece. They thought it was just going to be all glory and comfort and rulership along with Christ. Jesus says, no, the suffering is going to be so extreme that many of my followers will turn tail and run. They will deny me. Do you trust him in the midst of that suffering? Brother will betray brother to death and father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. Your own family members are going to be turning you in. Your own family members are going to turn on you. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. So Jesus says, my true followers, those are the ones that stand firm until the end. So do you trust him in the midst of betrayal and hatred? Some of us have had our families turn on us. It's incredibly painful. Some of us have been disowned, attacked, humiliated. We've had people real close to us attack us for our faith. So do you trust Jesus enough to keep serving him, enough to keep following him, even when everything around you is saying, no, you're wrong. You need to abandon Christ. He says, when you're persecuted in one place, flee to another. I tell you the truth, you'll not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. This mission to the Jews, this is not going to be accomplished until Jesus comes back. And so do you trust him, even if the mission is taking longer than you expected? Some people quit as the months stretch out into years, as those years stretch out into decades. And you're like, what's up with this? I got news for you. People are really stubborn. Christian work can take a long time, a lot longer than you might think. You might see some initial flashy gains, but as far as real deep change in people's hearts and in your own heart, it's going to take some time. He says, a student is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the student to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. If the head of the house has been called Beelzebub, Satan, how much more the members of his household? I remember last week they were saying Jesus drives out demons by the power of Satan. Do you trust that Jesus has been through far worse? He said, look, if I'm the teacher, and you guys are my students, don't you want to be like your teacher here? And with what I've been through, don't you think they're going to come after you as well? That's pretty comforting in times of suffering, to trust that Jesus has been through a whole lot more, that he knows how it feels, and to continue to place our trust in him in spite of how we're feeling. Don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. Do you trust that Jesus sees all the things that are happening to you, even if nobody else sees them? And do you trust that he will reward you, that he will make things right one day? He says, what I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What's whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. No more secrecy when we get to a certain point. Tell him everything about me. No more hush, hush. Don't tell anybody that I'm the Messiah. He says, when you start speaking up about that, they're going to have all targets are going to come on you. He says, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. I always thought that was talking about Satan, but it's not. It's talking about God. God is the one who decides your eternal destiny. Jesus Christ claims to be the one who you will stand before at the end of your life after your death. So have you entrusted your soul to the only one who can save it? And is that the only thing that matters to you? Or are you so worried about what other people think that you can't follow Christ? He says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. Even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You're worth more than many sparrows. Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. Whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven. It's my relationship with you. That's what matters. And the people that are mine, my followers, they will stand firm. I believe in you guys. I know you will. He says, do not suppose that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Do you trust Jesus enough to speak the truth no matter what the cost? You know, the truth is really offensive. Really offensive. People do not like hearing what Jesus has to say. Like we read a few weeks ago, that there's a broad path that almost everybody is on that leads to hell, and there's a real narrow path that leads to salvation. Very few find that. People don't like to hear that. People get pretty angry. Even people that claim to tolerate all religions will get furious with you if you start saying things like that. If you start declaring the truth, people are going to turn on you. Jesus is he's trying as hard as he can to prepare them for what lies ahead. He's trying to pierce through their rosy expectations that I'm just going to go be a missionary and, you know, everybody's just going to come flocking to me and sit at my feet like they do with Jesus right now. Jesus says, no. It's going to be a hard life. And he's saying some of the same things over and over again here to try to drill this into their heads. He says, I've come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Not that Jesus wants you to have a conflict, but he says, I've come to declare the truth. And that's going to lead to conflict. Again, with this family thing, Jesus keeps bringing this up. Several times this chapter alone, plus some other times earlier in the book. Relational pain is one of the main pains we're going to feel for following Christ. He says, a man's enemies will be the members of his own household. What a tragic situation. The people who are supposed to have your back, those are your enemies. People who, you know, you've been with for your entire life suddenly turn on you. That would be a pretty lonely place. He says, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Do you trust Jesus that this is the only way to find life? It's a pretty hard one to believe. You know, the list that he just read doesn't sound like a real happy life. And yet what Jesus says, this is the only way to find true life, true meaning, true joy, true significance and purpose. He said, you've got to get off the treadmill of trying to live your life for yourself. Trying to satisfy yourself at all costs. Trying to protect yourself. The self-protection has got to stop. It's time for some boldness. Knowing that we've been authorized by Jesus and sent by Him for a purpose. He's like, I don't want you to be like the person that, you know, watched Top Gun and then enlisted in the Navy. Because you want to play beach volleyball and great balls of fire. Jesus says, this is war. You're going to suffer. Some of you are going to die for this. Actually, of the 12 guys that were there, one of them bolted. 10 of them died for their faith. And the 11th one was died in exile, in a prison colony. Whoever finds his life will lose it. It's contradictory. It seems like I should try to protect myself and to gather everything that I can. And Jesus says, no. It's giving out. It's trusting me. That's the only way that you will ever find your life. And all of your efforts to grasp onto things, everything will slip through your fingers. And you know this is true. Maybe this is happening to you right now. You're trying to grasp on to your plans. And it's slipping through your fingers and you're miserable. And Jesus says, how about a different path? How about the path of the cross? Where you give up on your, you know, if you're carrying your cross to your grave site, you're not thinking about what am I going to do next year. You're not thinking about how much money is in your account balance. What you're thinking about is I've thrown in here and I'm going to Calvary. You know, I'm taking the way of Christ. Do you trust that this is the only way to find life? Ministry will stretch your faith. It will stretch your trust in God unlike anything else. There's going to be times where you're just clinging on for your life. Some of us will be thrown clear altogether. But Jesus says, do you trust me in spite of everything that's coming at you, that this is life? We'll close with verse 40. Jesus says, he who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me. Our mission is very important. It's our fifth and final principle. He says, you guys are going authorized by me, and if someone receives you, they receive me. Couldn't be more important. We're presenting Christ to people. We're presenting them to the final arbiter of their destiny, the person they will one day stand before after their death. And we're calling on them to make a decision now before it's too late. And so we'll close with three questions here. One, Have you received Christ? Like Jesus says here. Have you received Him? What does it mean to receive Christ? It means to admit you're right. I'm wrong. I've fallen way short of the standard of perfection that you modeled and taught. And I'm desperate here, Lord. I need forgiveness. I need a handout. I need your mercy. Nothing I can do to earn it. It's only you freely giving to me that I can receive this. 2, will you pray for workers for His harvest? Will you take up Jesus' charge here to see the need, to feel the need, to pray for the need that's out there? Will you pray for the work that God is doing? Will you pray your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven? And finally, are you willing to go as a worker into the harvest? Are you willing to set aside the other things that you've been pursuing and to say, God, I'm willing. I'm in. I want to have eternal significance. I want to do things that matter. I don't want to just accumulate a bunch of things that I won't even remember what I bought a couple years from now, and whatever I have left at the end of my life, I've got to leave behind. Are you willing to go as a worker into this harvest? Are you willing to go in the name of Jesus Christ, with the message of Jesus Christ, in the power of Jesus Christ, to the sheep that are harassed and helpless, the sheep without a shepherd, the acres of fields that are ripe for the harvest, and the fruit is just hanging there? Are you willing to go into the harvest? That's the challenge of Matthew 10. Yeah, Lord, the harvest is plentiful, and the workers are few. I thank you for all the people in this group who have stepped forward to answer your call. Your call to pray, your call to care, your call to even notice, and your call to go. I pray that you would call forth many workers for your harvest, Lord, from people in this room, Lord, and even more people that aren't in this room, people that we're going to meet, people we already know. I pray you would also call them into this harvest. I pray that you would send our church to continue to reach vast numbers of people here on this campus, but that we would also reach out into the rest of the United States, Lord, and into the rest of the world. I pray you'd bless our efforts to do that, and you'd guide us and direct us on how to go about that. And Lord, I thank you that you've given us a purpose. Thank you that you've given us a mission. And I pray if there's anybody here that has not received you, that they would not wait any longer, that they would turn to you in their hearts and admit their desperate need, and that they would receive the forgiveness that you're offering them, Lord. And I pray that you, when they do that, that you would affirm that decision in some way, and that they would realize that they're one of yours now, Lord. They're one of your sheep. They belong to the Good Shepherd. And I pray they would derive a tremendous sense of security and purpose from that. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.